Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of Mind Power. This is Donna Sebo. Today we're going to be talking about something that every one of us cannot do without. What is that? It's food. My guest today, John Eichler, we're going to be talking about crisis and opportunity, sustainability in American agriculture. It affects us all. Mr. Eichler, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to have an opportunity to visit with you this morning and hopefully talk to some of your listeners.
Well, we're not going to be talking to any listeners, but for the next half hour, I am excited about sharing some of the expertise that you have. And also, there is so much information in your book, Crisis and Opportunity, and so many of my listeners are people that are they're recyclists. They really see with clarity the changes that need to be made. And you bring a perspective to the table on a subject matter that I don't know that many people approach. Now, I want people to know that you have quite a background when it comes to talking about agriculture. I mean, you have represented the U.S. Department of Agriculture and the University of Missouri in facilitating and conducting sustainable agricultural research. You've also been involved with a lot of educational programs. But you were stimulated to take a different look from what your education and what a lot of your training had been. Tell us why sustainable agriculture became so significant to you, and what was it that made you feel that your thinking during a particular time was not correct and needed to be changed? What were those circumstances?
Well, it was actually during the 1980s, which I still refer to as the time of the farm financial crisis in agriculture. And during the 1970s, farmers had gone through a very prosperous time, a boom, so to speak, in agriculture commodity prices. Not all that different than we're experiencing now, but for different reasons. Back then, it was the export markets that were opening up. And so farmers had responded to that by expanding the size of their operations to take advantage of the expanding export markets. And many of them had borrowed heavily to borrow more land or buy new equipment or just build new buildings and do other things to expand their livestock operations. And unfortunately, when we got into the decade then of the 1980s, export markets dried up. We got into a global recession, and commodity prices fell, and farmers were caught with large debts and high interest rates, and it was a time of real crisis. So farm foreclosures and bankruptcies and even suicides were not uncommon at that time. And at that time, I was in University of Georgia. I was head of the Extension Agricultural Economics Department there. And part of our responsibility of my department was to go out and try to help these farmers find some way to survive economically during this particular stressful time. And really in face-to-face sort of conversations with farm families that we'd come in and members of my faculty, we'd sit down and go over their financial records and try to figure out some way to help them survive. In these face-to-face conversations, I came to realize that the farmers that had the greatest difficulties were really what we would have called the good farmers then. They were the farmers that were doing what those of us in the university system, the so-called farm financial experts, had been telling them to do in terms of maximizing their profits and increasing production and so on. And now they ended up with large debts that they couldn't pay and falling markets, whereas some of the farmers that we might have labeled as the laggards, the farmers that had not borrowed heavily and expanded, still had relatively diversified farms with both crop and livestock on them, they weren't doing particularly well, but anyway, they were doing relatively well compared to the others. And I just began to realize that there was something fundamentally wrong with the economics of agriculture that I had been taught in graduate school while I was getting my PhD in agricultural economics, and the economics basically that I'd been teaching to farmers for the past 15 years. And I realized it wasn't working for farmers at that time. And as I looked more deeply into it, I realized that kind of agriculture wasn't working for rural communities, because the rural communities were dependent upon farm families that were being forced out of business. And so rural communities, their businesses were closing up, and their churches and schools were closing or had relatively few people at risk of closing. And so it wasn't working for rural communities. And then I looked even further, and I realized it wasn't working for the land, because the pesticides and the fertilizers and the fuel not only was destroying the farms economically, but it was degrading the quality and the productivity of the soil and polluting the water and the air. And so overall, I just did, over a 10-year period or so, I come to the conclusion that this kind of industrial approach to agriculture that we economists had been promoting, and many economists and many agricultural experts continue to promote, quite simply was not sustainable.
So here we are in our world today. Our export market has shriveled. Here in the United States, we are experiencing an opposite positioning where we are importing more food than we are exporting. We're seeing a lot of our farmland disappear. I know here in the Pacific Northwest, we've got literally thousands of homes that have been built on rich, rich farmland that had for years had just been phenomenal. It's disappearing. An older generation that was totally dedicated to the land, they're not able to, let's say, really encourage your children to take it over because they're having a difficult time making it. And in your book, you make some very interesting statements. One is that agriculture by nature doesn't fit industrialization. It has to be forced to conform. And you have an image of the farmer, that of the future. You say it's going to take mind work, not physical or economic muscle, for the farmers of the future to find a niche where they carry out their function by means that are ecologically sound, economically viable, and socially responsible. I agree with you 100%. Now, you travel around the country talking to all of these groups. What is your response from the small to middle farmers? Because we don't have a heck of a lot of them left. What's the percentage of people that are actually farmers in our country today?
Well, it's a very small percentage of people that are actually farmers. The reports would indicate something like 2% of the people that are farming today are on farms. But when you look at that, about half of the farms that are classified as farms by USDA are really, the farmers there have give something other than farming as their principal occupation. They always ask them in the farm census, is farming your principal occupation? About half of the farmers that are out there are really do something else for a living. These are either rural residences where people own a few acres, you know, on the suburban fringe, and they may sell $1,000 worth of livestock or crops, which classifies them as a farmer. Or there may be farms where the farm family or the farmer has retired but continues to live there, or it may be hobby farms of various kinds that make up of roughly half of them. So we're down to, you know, maybe a million or so farms and farm population less than 1% that would be classified as people that have their principal occupation as farming. Now, contrary to the popular belief, a large number of the farmers that are still there that consider farming their principal occupation are on small farms. Now, a large portion of the total agricultural production comes from the relatively small number of large farms. For example, about 10 to 15% of the largest farms would produce like 80, 85% of total agricultural production. It varies from year to year depending on the prices of commodities and so on. So that leaves then 80, 85% of the farmers making their living producing like 10 to 15% of the total agricultural output. But even if we consider those farmers that just eliminate those that consider something other than farming as a principal occupation and retired, over half of the farmers that are out there are still on farms that sell less than $100,000 worth of product a year, and almost half sell less than $50,000 of product a year. Now, those farmers are not industrial farmers, as I call them. Industrialization in agriculture, as I characterize it, is about specialization, standardization. That means routinize the process, relying on chemical fertilizers, pesticides, irrigation, make the farm really work like an assembly line to the extent that you can. And once you've kind of simplified and routinized the farming operation, then you can consolidate control of it into larger and larger farming operations. And today the control is being consolidated under large agribusiness corporations. Much of the farming that takes place today is really contract operations with the large corporations basically calling all of the shots there. So these farmers that are still out here on the smaller farms simply haven't followed that process of standardization and specialization, consolidation of control, and they continue to be on relatively diversified smaller farming operations, many of them with crop and livestock operations and so on. And these are the farmers to whom the message of sustainable farming, which is inherently diverse and individualistic and site-specific, rather than and holistic in nature, rather than specialized, standardized, and consolidated in control. So I think sustainable agriculture is this kind of new vision. As I said before, and as you mentioned, agriculture doesn't really fit that industrial model of specialization, standardization, consolidation, because agriculture is still fundamentally a biological process. It's living systems. A farm is a living ecosystem made up of all the living organisms in the soil and the plants and the animals and even the farmers are all kind of a holistic sort of living organism. And healthy living organisms are always kind of holistic in nature in the sense that they're all interrelated. Everything that happens there affects everything else, and that's the way these living systems, including farms, actually are. Whatever you do on a farm impacts everything else that's there. And healthy living systems are inherently diverse. It takes a diversity of the living organisms, of plants and livestock and crops, in order to function in a way that maintains the health of that system. And living systems, then, that are healthy are interdependent. There's a mutually beneficial relationship. The waste of one species becomes the food for another, and one takes care of the other. One limits the other, but also supports the other. And it's these mutually beneficial relationships, then, that give the farm the ability to be regenerating and renewing and sustaining over the long time. And so this new paradigm or model of sustainable farming then is very much a living systems approach, which fits very well with the smaller and the medium-sized farming operations. The basic challenge is that just like in the 1980s when I was talking about you know, my responsibility and what I've done is gone out and kind of promoted this industrial approach to agriculture, it's still the farmers, when they go to the universities or when they read the major farm publications or when they get information from USDA or the State Departments of Agriculture, those organizations to a great extent are still promoting this industrialized approach to agriculture, even though it has never fit and will never fit with the smaller to moderate-sized farming operations.
I think that there is so much that in today's world, because of what we've accomplished since World War II with development of machines, and just yesterday I was listening to someone say that in our country especially, it is an environment where, as a nation, we don't have a lot of memories of mass starvation like so many other places in the world are experiencing today. I'm not saying we don't have hungry people in this country, but starvation where food is not available for millions. And because of a lot of the changes that evolved in farming, and because we learned how to develop equipment that enabled us to do certain things more effectively and efficiently. I mean, you see these huge combines going over tens of thousands of acres of wheat and various other products. There are these teams of people that just go across the country during certain seasons of the year and do the work. Of what used to take hundreds of people, now it's literally maybe 800 people, if that, running these huge machines so that we have food available to us. And this is on so many different levels. But there is a big difference between the way our agricultural patternings have evolved and the way agricultural patternings have evolved in Europe. And this person that was speaking was addressing the fact that the Europeans have a much different attitude because during the Second World War, and there's been so much of their history that has involved great periods of starvation and hunger. And when we forget that we have millions, literally billions, not millions, but billions of people to feed, do you have any apprehensions about that positioning? Because the U.S. during the Second World War, it was because we were able to bring enough food out. We were feeding the world. And we've done that in many respects for a long, long time. But now most of our food is being imported and our exports are diminishing. Would you address that?
Right. We adopted the kind of industrial approach to agriculture when it was thought that the greatest challenge in agriculture was increasing the agriculture productivity and expanding our ability to feed ourselves better with fewer people on the farms, and that freed up people to work in the factories and offices and really supported the whole industrialization of society. But and we employed that same sort of industrial model in agriculture. The important thing that's relevant to your question here is that just like the industrial era in general has always relied on cheap energy. First it was the old growth forest, and then it was the coal that was laying right on the surface of the ground. And for the last 100 years, it's been petroleum that at first would just punch a hole in the ground and it would gush out. But it's been cheap energy that's driven that. It was also cheap energy that allowed the industrialization of agriculture. The nitrogen fertilizer, which accounts for much of the increase of yields in those systems, is produced from natural gas. It's natural gas that provides the feedstock in terms of the minerals or elements that go in, but also that creates the pressure and the heat that allows the process of taking nitrogen out of the air and putting it into a form that we can feed the crops with. So we have an agriculture that's very energy intensive. It's the cheap fuel that allowed this agriculture to mechanize and also allowed us to specialize where we specialize in production in particular areas and ship products across the country, and now we ship them around the world. But it was cheap fuel that made that possible. It was the petroleum products and the petroleum technologies that made the pesticides possible that allowed the industrialization of agriculture. And so all of that so-called tremendous productivity that's there today is supported by relatively cheap energy. You know, people look at it and say, well, gasoline prices are high, and they are going up. And I think that's the critical challenge as we look to the future, because we have an agriculture today that uses about 10 calories of fossil energy, in addition to all the energy it collects from the sun, but 10 calories of fossil energy for every calorie of food energy that we consume.
Holy and Moses.
Even at the farm level, when you take out processing, transportation, and all that, even at the farm level, we're using about 3 calories of fossil energy for every food calorie, that we're producing there. And it's these industrial agricultural systems that are so energy intensive, with a reliance on commercial fertilizers and pesticides and fuel and mechanization and this sort of thing. The sustainable systems of agriculture, even with what we have now, there's been studies on organic that would cut fuel consumption or energy consumption by a third or more, and I think even with existing technologies we could cut it in half. But instead of trying to shift to this sustainable approach to agriculture, as we're approaching the time where I think virtually all the energy experts agree now that if we haven't peaked in terms of petroleum production, we're very close to it. And from here on out, we're simply not going to be able to produce more petroleum globally year after year for the next 50 years, because it takes like 30 years or so to bring an oil field to its peak production after you've explored or after you've discovered the field, and we're lagging so far behind in discoveries, even if you had a major discovery today, which no one thinks is likely, you know, it would be 30 years before you'd peak out of that field. So we're facing a future here now of declining fossil energy. And in addition to that, the other sources other than petroleum, particularly like coal, for example, has the environmental implications of releasing huge amounts of carbon into the atmosphere that aggravates the problem of global warming. And so we're here within 50 years of a major decline in available energy and a tremendous increase in the real prices of energy, particularly with the demand of energy for energy growing in places like India and China, which we attribute some of the increased food costs today to growing demand for food there, but they also have growing demand for energy as well. So we're on the cusp of basically the end of the industrial era, because it's the end of cheap energy. And instead of trying to create an agriculture that's capable of feeding people, even the people of the United States as well as people globally, with less fossil energy, what we've done is we've begun to transform agriculture into a producer of energy to try to offset the decline in fossil fuel. You know, it makes absolutely no sense to use an energy-intensive, energy-using agricultural system to try to produce a substitute for fossil energy. So if you want to have something to be concerned about in terms of food security in the future, it's not just a matter of the fact that we're importing more food now than before, because we're going to import even more as we transform more of our agriculture into producing fuel rather than food. But it's, if you look further down the road for another 10 or 15 years, we face a very serious threat to the sustainability, really, of human life on Earth if we don't fundamentally transform the nature of our agriculture to a more sustainable agriculture that's based on biological living systems and solar energy as opposed to its dependence on cheap fossil energy.
You have a very, even though we've been discussing some things for those that are listening, they might say, gee, this is very depressing. I don't know what to think about this. Because most people are not going to give too much attention to what's going on with food because we've become so accustomed. We have a 7-Elevens. We have all kinds of mega supermarkets. We have frozen food. We have things available to us that I know my grandmother didn't dream of having. She was born in 1900, and I just think of the wonderful things that have evolved just since that time frame. And yet you, for all of what you've discussed, you really have a very optimistic attitude, because you say the hope for the future is people. People in general are beginning to question the industrial agricultural system. And you talk about stewardship with the land.
Right.
And this, I think, is so important, because anyone I've ever known that has had a love of farming, and I think of someone I listened to last night, this gentleman got so very emotional about it. He said, I cannot even put into words how I feel about this land. Now, he's one of these people. He goes and he helps his dad, who's been a farmer ever since he was old enough to toddle around the farmland. He was raised on a farm, and his dad still lives on the farm. They have a few thousand acres. And then this son, he goes out on the weekends and on holidays. He goes and he helps his father, and his father has semi-retired. But his dad said, I just don't know what's going to happen to this farm because of the way things are today. I do not know how my grandkids and the great-grandkids are going to be able to have a life in doing this.
Right.
But the stewardship, the attitude of stewardship was so obvious with this family and the people in the family.
Well,
this is something you really believe in, and you're seeing more and more of this evolving. What would you say to anyone that's listening and said, I would love to have a farm. I would just love to do this. I would like to be supportive of this. So we save the land, so we treat it well. What would you recommend that they do?
Well, the hopefulness I have for the future, and I think it starts with this understanding of it, is that a growing number of people, I think, are awakening to the reality of the unsustainability of agriculture, what we're doing to the land, what we're doing to rural communities, what we're doing to farmers. And it's being reflected in the growing demand in the marketplace for things like organic food. Organic has been the fastest growing segment of the food system now for almost 20 years, growing at 20% per year during much of that time, which means it's doubling every 3 or 4 years. More recently, we see a tremendous growth. The fastest growing section now is in local foods, and that's where people have, I think, have lost some confidence in the organic food that's in the big industrial food system, so to speak, in the traditional supermarket chains, and so they're looking for relationships at local level. But this is the hopefulness for the future of farming is in the change in attitudes on the part of food consumers, that an increasing number of people, I think at least a quarter and probably a third of the people in this country, and probably even more in Europe and other places, have lost confidence in this industrial food system. They simply don't want to spend, including myself in this, I do not want to spend my money supporting a system of food production that not only produces unhealthy and lack of nutrition in our food, but also is degrading the land and is exploiting people, the farm workers and the farmers in the process of producing my food. And so as more and more people ask for something different, and they're looking for it, and there's tremendous growth in farmers' markets across the country, almost tripling in the last 10 to 15 years, growth in CSAs and direct sales of all kinds, and organic and local, and hormone, antibiotic-free, grass-fed, free-range, humanely treated. Now, there's a whole range of different food products. And every one of these represents an opportunity for a farmer that shares those values, a farmer that's willing to that produce products that people want, that are healthful, that are nutritious, but equally important, are produced in a way that reflects a sense of stewardship for the land and a concern for the future generations, trying to pass the land on to the next generation as productive as it was when it was passed to them, and to being a part of a caring community and caring about their neighbors and being a place to build strong families. When you bring together the consumers that are supporting that motivation with their dollars and the farmers that are willing to produce that way, it creates the tremendous opportunities that I've talked about as we look to the future. I think the most important and most positive and hopeful sign of the future is the awakening among the people that our quality of life and our happiness is not just about having more cheap stuff, whether it's food or cars or houses or whatever. It's not just about material wealth. But it's about the quality of our relationships within families, within communities, with our neighbors. And it's about having a sense of purpose and meaning that comes from an ethic of stewardship and a sense of responsibility to humanity. As I like to say, that the realization that we owe a debt to those of the past, that we have to repay to the future, and that with each payment on the debt, then our lives are made better, not worse. And there's a whole body of scientific evidence that's emerging, a whole discipline of, some people call it the study of happiness or positive psychology, where they're documenting this fact that even though we've had tremendous material progress in this country and in Europe over the past 50 years, our happiness has not increased. That the happiness of people, the research is showing, is about relationships, and it's about the sense of ethics and morality and purpose and meaning in life. And as we begin to live our lives in ways that truly reflect the pursuit of happiness rather than simply the pursuit of wealth, then we'll transform and create opportunities for farmers out here that want to pursue that same quality of life on the farms as we're trying to pursue as consumers.
Now, John, do you have a website that people can go to?
Yes, I do. The easiest way to find it over the... there's very few people named John Eichert, I-K-E-R-D. So if you go and do a Google search or a Yahoo search or whatever of John Eichert, I-K-E-R-D, then you're going to find, you know, I have two or three websites. They'll come to the top of the search list. So that's the easiest way to find it as opposed to me trying to give you a, you know, like my university web address.
Wonderful. John Eichert has been my guest. His last name is spelled I-K-E-R-D. You can Google that name. You'll find out that he has three websites available. This fascinating book, Crisis and Opportunity, Sustainability in American Agriculture. If you are interested in learning more about farming, in learning about the changes, the history, all kinds of information that will inform you and educate you, you may find that you will not only be making a statement with how you use the money in your wallet, but you will be able to see how you can support and sustain the agricultural changes of a positive nature that are happening, that are going to bring better health to us, to our friends, to our family, and make this world a better place. John Eicher, thank you so much for being my guest today. This is Donna Sebo. We're taking a break, and when we come back, more good things to share. Stay tuned.
Hello, this is Dr. Richard Petty, the author of Healing, Meaning, and Purpose, and creator of the RichardGPettyMD.com website. I am thrilled and delighted to tell you that starting February 7th, 2008, at 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 p.m. Eastern, I'm going to be joining my friend Donna Sebo on her show on BBSRadio.com. We're going to do this every month, and I can guarantee you that we're going to be sharing new information and new concepts that will astonish and inspire you.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, ttap.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717. TTAP.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Telephone lines are open, and I want to invite you. If you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight, this is all you have to do, 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. Also, we have a direct line of 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. Now, all you need to do is give me your first name or your initial, and then after that, I'll give you my mental impressions, and then you're welcome to ask me a question about anything that you desire. I'm an information resource, and I am delighted to be able to share these skills and talents with you on the air. And I have been getting some emails from people. Again, I want to let you know I do not do readings via email. I'm available by private appointment, so all you have to do is call my office at 800-872-8852. And I've received a beautiful mother's story, and I wanted to share it. Mom's Day is coming up pretty soon. Boy, you hear all kinds of ads that are just coming at you from right, left, up, down, inside and out. And it's a wonderful holiday, and I think it's great when you can be appreciated as a mom. But when I got this story, I thought, I have got to share it with you because it is so well done. And my friend Rosemary, she sent it to me, and she had received it from a friend who had gotten it from a guy, and I said, this is just something, again, I want to share. Now, before I do that, it looks like we've got a caller on the line, so let me take care of the caller, and then we'll get to the special mom story. It's titled, The Invisible Mom. Okay, caller, welcome to the show. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Susan from Tempe, Arizona.
Hi, Susan.
Hi.
Sun is shining, I bet, in Tempe, Arizona.
Very, very hot.
very, very hot. Well, I'm nice and cool up here in the Pacific Northwest. We're all of a whopping in the 40 degrees, 40, 45, I think somewhere in there. Whew, what a difference. All right, Susan, one thing that is coming into mind right away is procrastination with a capital P is your worst enemy. Do not procrastinate. There is something that is on the table of action that you need to really put to work. What it is at this moment, I'm not able to discern, but you do need to put it to work. Also, what I'm watching is an upheaval of some kind, and I'm looking at a month with the letter J. So we're past January, so it's either June or July, and I'm inclined to think it might be June. Now, there's a conflict that could be evolving, and you may be getting little signals about this potential conflict, but you've been able to pretty much keep it at bay. Don't be surprised if there is going to be a verbal discussion, that's the word I'll use, that could be rather animated, and you want to be of the mindset of being prepared to handle this when it comes up. There are some individuals that are in your environment that have a tough time communicating openly. It's like they'll do a lot of thinking, but by the time they speak what's on their mind, a lot of water can go under the bridge. So it's important that you learn how to ask questions so that you don't have these surprises that knock you for a loop. And it's important to be aware that your planning is going to make all the difference in the world and the follow-through in a timely manner as well. What's on your mind today? What did you want to ask me?
I wanted to know if the partnerships that I've set up so far with a particular committee are going to remain intact for the time being.
Well, I would say currently they're going to be staying together. 3 months from now, they may not. And I'm looking at one individual in particular. So if you have this partnership association with people, I think what you're learning how to do is to communicate with them and then find out what their commitment is. But you need to have additional persons in the environment. So should one or two bow out, that you've got something backing it up. And I think what's evolving is a development of two individuals in particular that I feel will have the commitment that you really want from them. By the way, I have got to ask you, are you exhausted? All of a sudden when I'm focusing on you, I am picking up this, I can barely keep my eyes open, feeling, and
yes.
Then I'm also, I just seem to have like a dullness in the middle of my body. Have you really been having an urge for either a lot of chocolate or a lot of sugar? It's like you want something to give you energy quickly?
Not energy so much as at times it's the typical, you know, having a fix, a sugar fix. But it's not, that's not extraordinary. It's more about the exhaustion that will come on. And I've been getting the kind of sleep that I just go into this deep sleep, and I haven't had that for like decades, and it's that I find a blessing, but it's weird. It's just very weird. It comes on and I just go into a very deep sleep. So I almost welcome that. It's still new. I hope it's not evolving into anything.
Well, I think you need to pay attention to the patterning on this. Because what I'm looking at in my mind is that it has something to do with circulation. Two, I think you're tapping out certain nutritional factors in your body. And three, I'd love to see you get a slant board. Make one of your own. And this is where you just lay down. You can do this on the floor even. You can just lay down on the floor and elevate your feet 6 inches off the floor and just lay there. Now, on a slant board, then your whole body's at a slant. It's just not your legs. And what that does, that encourages sort of an additional blood flow into the brain, but it's very refreshing for the body in totality. I just think you're burning yourself out. I think you're burning out your resources. And that's why you need to have it. And I believe that if you can cultivate little mini naps, that it will enable you to work under some pretty intense and even stressful environments and situations. And yet you won't feel depleted. You'll be able to retreat and do that for yourself. I think that's very, very important. And you could easily train yourself to do what a Marine I met many years ago would do and say, I'm going to lay down for 15 minutes, go into this deeper sleep or restfulness, and then come out feeling totally refreshed. I think that that is very important. It's just the way your body uses energy. And so you need to be aware of that and be sure that you have munchies like fresh fruit or some protein that's easy and comfortable for you to digest. You really are a muncher, and you need to have those munchies so that you maintain this energy level, because I just felt myself just totally depleted when I was focusing on you, especially around my eyes. It's just like they got so heavy. I just wanted to sort of curl up like a little squirrel and go to sleep. And I think you need to pay attention to this, and it might be a good idea if you kept a log to note what your sleep patterns are and also how you are seeing this roller coaster effect with your energy. And I think you'll figure it out on your own.
You're not picking up diabetes, are you? I've been so...
No, I don't think you need to go there.
Okay,
I don't
good.
Think that's it at all.
Good.
But you need to honor and respect the physical vehicle that you've got.
Okay.
You don't need to go into any kind of extremism of concern.
Okay.
What you need to do is pay attention to the signals that the body's giving you.
Yes, you're right. I agree.
If you do that and see the rhythm of it,
okay,
then you'll be able to figure it out.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You are welcome. You have a wonderful day now.
God bless.
Bye-bye, dear. This is Donna Sebo. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. This is what I love to do. 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756, and also 530-876-3222. This is the story I said I would share with you. It's all about the invisible mom. And this is how it reads. It all began to make sense, the blank stares, the lack of response, the way one of the kids would walk into the room while I'm on the phone and ask to be taken to the store. Inside, I'm thinking, can't you see I'm on the phone? Obviously not. No one can see if I'm on the phone or cooking or sweeping the floor or even standing on my head in the corner, because no one can see me at all. I'm invisible. I'm the invisible mom. Some days I'm only a pair of hands, nothing more. Can you fix this? Can you tie this? Mom, can you open this? Some days I'm not a pair of hands. I'm not even a human being. I'm a clock to ask. Mom, what time is this? I'm a satellite guide to answer. What number is the Disney Channel, Mom? I'm a car to order. Right around 5:30, Mom. Pick me up, please. I was certain that these were the hands that once held books and the eyes that studied history and the mind that graduated summa cum laude. But now they had disappeared into the peanut butter, never to be seen again. She's going. She's going. She's gone. One night, a group of us were having dinner, celebrating the return of a friend from England. Janice had just gotten back from a fabulous trip, and she was going on and on about the hotel she stayed in. I was sitting there looking around at the others, all put together so well. It was hard not to compare and feel sorry for myself. I was feeling pretty pathetic when Janice turned to me with a beautifully wrapped package and said, I brought you this. It was a book on the great cathedrals of Europe. I wasn't exactly sure why she had given it to me until I read her inscription. To Charlotte, with admiration for the greatness of what you are building when no one sees. In the days ahead, I devoured this beautiful book. I would discover what would become for me 4 life-changing truths after which I could pattern my work. No one can say who built the great cathedrals. We can have records of their names. These builders gave their whole lives for a work they would never see finished. They made great sacrifices and expected no credit. The passion of their building was fueled by their faith that the eyes of God saw everything. I'm going to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to hear a little bit more about the Invisible Mom and what she learned. This is Donna Sebo. Don't go away. I'll be right back.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Sebo. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make
Donna
a difference
Sebo
for you.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at Donna@DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna@DelphiInternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.DelphiInternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is Donna@DelphiInternational.com, and her website is www.DelphiInternational.com.
Hi, this is Donna Sebo. Don't forget, you can give me a buzz at 877-8765-227 or 888-815-9756. Well, I was talking to you about the Invisible Mom before we went on break, and this is the continuation of the email that I had received. There was a legendary story in this book that this mom was given that told of a rich man who came to visit this cathedral while it was being built, and he saw a workman carving a tiny bird on the inside of a beam. He was puzzled and asked the man, "Why are you spending so much time carving that bird into a beam that will be covered by a roof? No one is ever going to see it." The workman turned to the man that asked the question and said very simply, "Because God sees." After this particular mother had read the book, she felt like the missing piece was falling into place. She said, "It was almost as if I heard God whispering to me, 'I see you, Charlotte. I see the sacrifices you make every day, even when no one else is around, and they don't see what you do. No act of kindness you've done, no sequin you've sewed on, no cupcake you baked is too small for me to notice and smile over. You're building a great cathedral, but you can't see right now what it will become. At times, my invisibility feels like an affliction, but it is not a disease that is erasing my life. It is the cure for the disease of my own self-centeredness. It is the antidote to my strong, stubborn pride. I keep the right perspective when I see myself as a great builder, as one of the people who show up at a job that they'll never see finished, to work on something that their name will never be on." The writer of the book went so far as to say that no cathedrals could ever be built in our lifetime because there are so few people willing to sacrifice to that degree. When I really think about it, I don't want my son to tell the friend he's bringing home from college for Thanksgiving. My mom gets up at 4 a.m. in the morning and bakes homemade pies, and then she hand bastes the turkey for 3 hours and presses all the linens for the table. That would mean I'd built a shrine or a monument to myself. I just want my son to come home. And then, if there's anything more to say to his friend, to add, You're going to like it there. As moms, as mothers, we are building great cathedrals. We cannot be seen if we're doing it right. And one day it is very possible that the world will marvel not only at what we have built, but at the beauty that has been added to the world by the sacrifices of the invisible mom. Great job, Mom. Share this with all the invisible moms you know. Well, ladies, there it is. Donna Sebo here. Give me a buzz if you'd like to chat. 877-876-5227. Canadians, 888-815-9756. Or you can buzz me at 530-876-3222. Don't forget, on the 9th of June, I'm doing a special broadcast in Spain on rem.fm.com. And for those of you who are web savvy, it's going to be from 5:20 on in the morning, Pacific time. Now, you may not want to get up that early, but they will have the broadcast on the archives there at rem.fm.com. Tomorrow, we're going to be talking about United Symbolism of America. Oh, yes, we've got all kinds of symbolism in so many things associated with the United States. Dr. Bob Hieronymus is going to be my guest. And then on Friday, we are going to be talking about a very special dog, Merle's Door. Merle is the dog, and you, if you're an animal lover, you're not going to want to miss this. It's just absolutely great. So that's the lineup for the rest of this week, and we have got a terrific lineup of guests. You can go into bbsradio.com, check out the schedule that I fill out every month. I do want to let you know that Dr. Petty, who is a physician that we have on every month, he's going to be changing his time. He's going to be on the air with me live on Memorial Day. So just know that he has been changed. We had him booked for the 16th of this month, but he's going to be speaking in a part of the country, so we're changing to Memorial Day on the 26th. And yes, the Donna Sebo Show will be live on that holiday. So just know you can go in, you can go check out my website, you can find out the guests that are coming up. They're listed there. They are also listed at BBS Radio. And shows are archived. So no matter where you are, you can always, whatever part of the world you might be in, you can always go into the archives and you can listen to our programming. That's something we're delighted to be able to provide to you. Okay, I don't know about you, but boy, sometimes I just am in a hurry. Who has time to cook? Yeah. Not me, and I love to cook. I love sharing recipes, but sometimes the schedule really gets hectic. Well, how would you like a recipe that's really fast and easy? I'm going to give you a quick one here. It's spicy sesame noodles. Now, whole wheat spaghetti is really good for you, and this is something that's so easy, and it's going to be just perfect for that rush meal that you want to put together for your family. You can make it double this, or you can make it half, depending on the amount of people you're going to be serving. Now, there's a pound of uncooked soba noodles or whole wheat spaghetti. You need two cups of fresh broccoli florets, 2 cups of that, 2 tablespoons of peanut oil, 2 tablespoons of peanut oil. If you're allergic to peanut oil, to pick another oil, 1 tablespoon of dark sesame oil, 1 tablespoon of dark sesame oil, 1 tablespoon of soy sauce, 1 tablespoon of soy sauce, 1 teaspoon of hot sauce, or more if you like it really spicy, 1/2 teaspoon of crushed red pepper flakes, 1/2 cup of scallions, chop them fine, white and green, and 1/2 cup of shredded carrots. Then you need a little bit of salt and pepper. Now, this is how simple it is. You cook your noodles according to directions, add your broccoli in the last 30 seconds, drain broccoli and noodles, rinse them under cold water, transfer the noodles and broccoli to a bowl, add your peanut oil, sesame oil, soy sauce, hot sauce, red pepper flakes, toss to combine, stir in your scallions and carrots, season to taste with salt and pepper. If you want, add dry roasted peanuts on the top before you serve it. Sweet, simple, easy, different. I like it. What do you think? This is Donna Sebo. We're out of time. Remember always, you are the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. It is a joy to be able to spend this time with you. You make a difference. You make the choices that you feel are right for you, your family, and know that you make a difference when you make those choices. Talk to you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here at BBS Radio. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.
Where would $5,000 per week take you? Discover the exact details of a simple and proven system that quickly puts $5,000 to $10,000 in many students' pockets every week. What's most amazing is that there are almost no computer skills required, and you can start pulling in cash automatically within just a few hours. We are absolutely convinced that our proven system will create massive wealth for virtually anyone, and we'll prove it. Go to bbscashflow.com now and get all the details. That's bbscashflow.com.